The title of this conference by Father John Hardin is Our Witness to the World. Father Hardin, a member of the Society of Jesus, is professor of systematic theology at the Bellarmine School of Theology, Loyola University, Chicago, Illinois. He is author of many books and articles published in the United States, Canada, and Europe. His latest book is Christianity in the 20th Century. Father Hardin is a lecturer and consultant to various national, religious, and educational enterprises. He is renowned as a retreat master and spiritual director. Father Hardin has been a consultant to the consortium from its beginning and is closely associated with its interests as a communication enterprise for religious women in the United States. Father Hardin.
The Beatitudes, Our Witness to the World. Suppose we backtrack for a few minutes to see where we stand and how the Beatitudes fit into what we wish during this meditation to reflect on. We saw, first of all, that the Beatitudes have two parts. First, the promise of happiness, and then a condition for its being obtained. Consequently, if we live out the conditions, we shall obtain the happiness indicated by Christ. Secondly, if we do fulfill the condition, we will experience what he promised. Happiness is not something you read about. It's something you experience. Then, having the experience, we shall radiate what we have experienced inevitably. And thereby we shall testify to all who enter our lives to the value and validity of Christ's teaching. That, you might say, is the logic of the Beatitudes as witness. We wish now to look at the Beatitudes themselves. There are a few retreats, even a weekend retreat, that I don't use the Beatitudes for one meditation. They are simply too fundamental to our faith. But first, I think, an important prelude to remind ourselves that this is not a series of lectures, but a retreat. The main purpose of a retreat is to come to, first of all, know what's wrong with us. To find out what God wants us to do. Then to select among the things that need improvement or, frankly, reformation in our lives, in the light of God's will, in all regard. Having made the selection, and there's usually enough to work on, we decide and resolve on what Christ wants me, and it's not someone else, but me now, to do or give up or omit or do better. The Beatitudes, and this is a new way, I hope, of seeing them in this context, I think are a perfect examination of commitment. In other words, of the degree of our generosity. They are not only, as I am suggesting they should be, a fine checklist for making our retreat resolutions, but a correspondingly good checklist for every day of our lives. I don't think it's too much to suggest that we ask ourselves daily on how well I have kept one or the other of the Beatitudes. Know the Beatitudes themselves. And still one more piece of introduction. We'll get to them. We often speak correctly of the mysteries of our faith. So they are. But if there are mysteries of faith, there are what I call paradoxes of Christian living. A paradox, you know, is an apparent contradiction that contains and sometimes conceals a deep truth. Because in each case, the paradox of the Beatitudes is the exemplification in our lives, if we live them, of what Christ keeps saying throughout the Gospels, you gain by losing. Now listen to this. You get by giving. In fact, by giving up. With that, finally, as an introduction, we take up each of the Beatitudes, necessarily, very briefly, but I hope concisely. The first Beatitude reads, in Matthew's version, "How happy are the poor in spirit, theirs is the kingdom of heaven." Remember the way we want to look at these Beatitudes, and there are many viewpoints possible. It's the viewpoint here of witness. What does the first Beatitude imply? It implies that a person is not necessarily and normally actually poor. He is rich. In fact, but poor in spirit, meaning he is rich in whatever he may have, and we've got plenty, but not attached to what we have. In each case, we'll glance, and it has to be for just a moment, at the philosophy of this world, or as we call it, the philosophy of this worldly happiness. To be rich and to be strongly attached to what you've got, to be proud of it, to get more. One of the most pathetic stories I've ever heard that I think somewhat exemplifies the spirit of worldly happiness was told me by a priest who went to visit a man on his deathbed, a Cincinnati millionaire. It seems he was dying, but shortly before his death, fully conscious, he asked somebody to go to his investment office and cash all his investments. Say it was $1 million or more. Bring all the money in an express truck to the hospital and lay the money out all over the hospital room, on the dresser, on the stand, all over his bed. The priest walked in. He thought he saw an apparition. Let's hope the man was not all there. The priest swears he was perfectly sane. Isn't that the spirit of the world? To hug and admire and accumulate. And as the little sisters of the poor with whom I stayed for 2.5 weeks after my pleasant month in the hospital, you know, they go out begging every day. They tell me, as a general rule, the more wealthy, the less they get. So it is not, this first beatitude, not having, and frankly, the nickels and dimes that we gave up our vow of poverty. Well, what's a nickel or a dime? All kinds of riches we do possess. Let's not misunderstand this beatitude that because we've taken a vow of poverty, that somehow, well, we can check that beatitude off our list. Oh, we can be and are rich in fact, gifted with intelligence, by and large above the ordinary, skills, education, abilities of all kinds, and achievements. But this poverty of spirit means that no matter how rich we may be, and we all qualify, that we are not attached to what we've got. And the word I've got in my notes is not complacent. That we don't keep staring at, admiring ourselves, thinking of how good I have been, how well I have said this or done that. And the best single mark of detachment is, I know, sisters, I know how hard it is to practice it, is to do something which you honestly know was good and to get no feedback. You know what I mean? Like the one speech that I gave in Chicago. Generally, most audiences are at least polite. This one didn't even applaud. For a long minute, a pall of silence. Well, I think I scare them. Poor in spirit, if rich in fact, we do not admire ourselves, are not attached to the things that we've got. And the promise? Listen, that's the first beatitude. Theirs is, and the Koine Greek is, present tense, theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Great. A foretaste of heaven. Second beatitude. How happy are the gentle. They shall possess the land. Or they shall have the land for their heritage. What is gentleness? I define it as strength restrained by love. In other words, it takes a strong person to be gentle. So again, just as in the first beatitude, it doesn't mean that a person is actually poor, destitute, which we are not in the things that really count. Nor in the second case does it mean that we're supposed to be weak. All kinds of terms you can use. The wallflower type. The shy, retiring, afraid of her shadow type. Strong, in fact, but kind. What a combination. I'd like to think of some actual picture to sort of illustrate ideas. Most times I fail. Here's my figure of speech for gentleness. A huge boulder at the edge of a high mountain, overlooking a precipice. If nothing ever falls, it would crush anything below. Strength restrained. And as you know, the most powerful strength we've got is not in muscle, but in mind. What about the world's philosophy of strength? Use it and crush anyone who stands in the way. Whether it's a business competitor, or, for example, in conversation, if somebody starts monopolizing the conversation, raise your voice. Or if they told a good story which, well, they raised a laugh or got attention, you do him one better. Sisters, it's in the subtleties of our daily life that these beatitudes are lived. How often have we bitten our lips with a good, juicy story ready to tell, but knowing that if we did, we would steal the limelight from someone who is obviously being here listened to and admired. What's the promise? Now you might say to yourself, who wants the land for his heritage anyhow? That's symbolic language. The promise is an important one, and for us religious, an indispensable one. It is influence over others. The proverbs of all nations are filled with the strength exercised by those who are gentle, kind, and considerate. Many people in our lives, it may be students, it may be others, who may be intractable. Now that doesn't mean, and by the way, that strength is important. It may be the student in the back of the room that's cutting up has got to know, as I in one unguarded moment told one of my students in chemistry in Detroit for my ordination, whatever he was doing, he got me roiled up. Whatever name I used, let's use a synonym, Buster. You know how I feel? What I like to do is pick you up and throw you through the back wall. Before I said it, I looked at his size. So it isn't that a person is weak, but that he restrains his strength out of love for the one whom he wants to bring to Christ. And is that ever hard? To be insulted by a person, you've listened to him for the last 30 minutes. You've seen that mind before. You can classify it immediately. Low grade. In 10 seconds, you can make mincemeat out of his personality. But you don't. How happy are the gentle? They will be influential. The fourth beatitude, pardon me, we're not there yet. Third. How happy are they who mourn? They shall be comforted. If there is any beatitude that sounds more like a contradiction than a paradox, it's this one. It's as though Christ said, how happy are the unhappy? Come now, Lord. What do you mean? Clearly, there's a lot of sorrow in this world, and those who follow Christ have no monopoly on sorrow. There is pain for all of us. But the mourning that Christ bids us practice and promises us comfort is the sorrow that has a reason for being sorrowful. I like the two occasions in which Christ wept. Remember? One was at the grave of Lazarus, and the other over Jerusalem. Perfect. In our lifetimes, we've all lived long enough, some longer than others, to have had God put into our lives loved ones whom he has taken away. He can take them away in different ways. He can take them by moving us or them. He can take them away by just, well, I just now have another class. He can take them away by a misunderstanding, and a rift falls between us. He can take them away by death. Christ's weeping at the grave of Lazarus was very human. And in our lives as religious, I think we can all, those especially who have been in the community for some years, will agree that sometimes God seems to put the most wonderful people in our lives almost in order that he might take them away. In fact, he always will. That sorrow, provided it's not uncontrolled, is human, Christ-like, part of the sacrifice. Weeping over Jerusalem What would Christ have done if he had, say, looked over any of our large metropolitan cities? We know that Christ is eternal. He wants us, by the way, as members of his mystical body and the extension of his personality, to weep. Sometimes, even real tears, over the crimes, the offenses against God. The city of Chicago has the dubious record of having over 400 unsolved murders every year. Think of the debauching of millions of the young through pornography, on which people are making millions. Think of the priests who turned back on the Christ who ordained them. I know, sisters. I've taught them. I've met them since. Though I have no sons of my own physically, I think I know what it means for a father to lose a son. All of these are, and Christ tells us, worthy reasons for sorrow. That's the morning of the Beatitude. And the promise? Not to have the sorrow removed, but, and the word comfort is the one we use. It means strengthened. You know, in the philosophy of the world, meeting trial and difficulty no less than we crushes them. And for our purpose, what trifles, what baubles, what insignificant things can destroy, in fact? Do you know that the largest number of suicides are among the most wealthy? The fourth beatitude, how happy are those who hunger and thirst for what is right. They shall be satisfied. Now here, as we have been seeing all along, everyone has hunger and thirsts. In other words, we all have desires for which hunger and thirsts are the biblical symbol. The important thing for us is that our desires be for what is right. Well, what is right? For the things that God wants. In other words, according to this beatitude, we should desire what God wants. Or, to put them both on the same level, we should want what God wants.
This conference is continued on Side B.